Coming up next on This Week in Radio Tech, Gordon Carter is our guest. Who's Gordon Carter? He was the chief engineer at WFMT, perhaps the most premier fine arts radio station in the U.S., and they had an audio quality for decades that was just unsurpassed. How did he do it? What did he learn? And how did he apply what he learned to his studios and equipment? Gordon Carter is coming up next on TWRT.
This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, savings, and support, online at bgs.cc. By Broadcast Bionics, with the Bionic Studio, including talk show control, social media, and visual radio, Broadcast Bionics brings exceptional audience engagement to radio and TV. By Angry Audio, audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. And by MaxConnect Wireless, prioritized high-speed internet service designed for transmitter sites and remote broadcasts.
Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about everything from the microphone, like this one, to the light bulb at the top of the tower, which I don't have with me on this episode. Coming to you from the Chattanooga office of This Week in Radio Tech. Hi, I'm Kirk Harnack. Delighted that you're here. It's our 570th episode. We've been around here about 12 years talking about radio technology, and we've had all kinds of fantastic guests. People, you know, we always look for, you know, people who are smarter than you to come on, right? So that way you can learn something. And we've, my mic's a bit hot, turn that down. We will get some great information today from our guest, who is Gordon Carter. Let's go ahead and bring Gordon in. Gordon, welcome to the show. I'm so glad you're here, sir.
I'm glad to be here.
So, Gordon, we're going to have an hour coming up of some learning, not only about your past, and that's great, people are interested in that, but we're very interested in understanding how your experiences in the past led you to even better designs, better installations, better audio, better radio in the recent past and in the present, right?
That's a good way to sum it up.
All right.
Where do you want to start?
Well, I'm going to start actually with talking about a friend of ours, and that is Ray Topp, who publishes Radio Guide magazine. Here, hold it on this side. Radio Guide. Gordon, I always give a little shout out to Radio Guide because they give a shout out to me. The website is radio-guide.com, radio-guide.com. What I like about Radio Guide is it's all about engineering. There's not really much in terms of management information in here. It's about engineering, and the articles are longer, and even better yet, There's your monthly reminder to tune into This Week in Radio Tech. So I appreciate Ray Topp putting this little ad in there for our show. No, but seriously, Radio Guide is good because the articles are more in-depth, and they talk about real how-to information from other engineers, just like you, who maybe specializes in local area networks or storage area networks or underground drilling, horizontal drilling to get a new cable out to a tower somewhere. All kinds of good information is in Radio Guide at radio-guide.com. Thanks again to Ray Topp for publishing Radio Guide. It does come out in print every 2 months. This edition here is the September-October edition. I'll be looking for my next one coming in the mail pretty soon. And you should look for it too. But in the meantime, go to the website, radio-guide.com. Okay, Gordon, we've got a few minutes before our first spot break right now, and we ought to just introduce you to folks with you telling us a story of kind of how you got into radio and how you got your way to Chicago. If you just want to take off on that, we'd be glad to hear it.
Okay. Well, before we start with that, let's do just a quick plug. I used to write for Radio Guide. Many years ago, back in the early 90s, something like 30 articles over a few years for Radio Guide. So those are available. I don't know if Radio Guide has them on their website, but I have a website at gcarter.us, and there's copies that available there if you'd like to go back and read some ancient history.
Interesting. We will put that website in the show notes so that people don't have to remember it right now, but they can go to our show notes and click on it and go to your website. So thanks for that.
Right. I got started actually in high school. Was interested in various and assorted things, like a lot of high school kids. And I had a friend who was part owner of a radio station, and he invited me to come visit. And that was all it took. I saw the equipment. He had a nice new Gates executive board, and man, that thing was really, I had to know how that thing worked, and the transmitter as well. How did it work, and how could I make it work? And so I did. In high school, I built from scratch, sort of, a stereo amplifier. I wanted stereo. All I had was an old 78 RPM phonograph, a little portable. I opened it up, looked inside, said, I can do that. I had no idea what I was doing, but I copied it. And I knew that stereo meant two. So I made two of them. And I sent off for parts to a place called Allied Electronics. Many people in the industry would remember from a long time ago. And got speakers, a turntable, tone arm, cartridge, and built it all together. And lo and behold, the silly thing worked. And that was it. I had to do more, and I had to know more about how it worked. You know, it always puzzled me why, what do all these things do? Well, now I know. And of course, that was all tubes too. So that would have been in the early 60s.
Okay.
And, I remember it was a 35 Z5 and a 50, I forget what it was. There were two tubes and series filaments and to get to 110 volts.
Wow. And that was a phonograph amp. Now, and you mentioned 78s. Now, 78s were, I think those were all always mono, right?
Right.
So you were building something to play the new LPs, the stereo long playing records.
Now, looking back, no, I didn't have the EQ right, but it sounded good enough for me at the time. Hmm. And that was my first thing I built. I built a tube type microphone preamp. And that was straight out of the RCA tube catalog.
Oh, so you used a reference diagram in the tube catalog and built up a mic pre with that. Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's interesting because when you were doing that, I mean, not at the same time, I came along 15 years later and I'm just building things from kits. Now, I still learned a lot, but you were figuring out what things did. I didn't have to figure it out, although I liked to, but I built stuff from kits. You built stuff from scratch.
Right. And it's interesting that the kids that are coming up now, they're doing the same thing, only they're doing it with Raspberry Pis and Arduinos and all of that stuff. It's the same idea. It's the curiosity of how things work, but different era, different technology.
We're going to get to a story in a little bit, whenever you decide to tell it, about how you came up with some equipment that had this incredibly, wonderfully low noise floor, and it was analog gear. And what I want to say about that is today you can buy off-the-shelf components that give you really incredible performance. But back when you were designing these things, you had to design that performance in by clever and reasonable circuit design and just clever ways to do things. If you just built it from the reference diagram and built things with, who knows, with relays or whatever, you were going to have noise and crackle and dirt and sparks and a noise floor that you may not have been proud of. So I'm eager to hear a little bit later on in our broadcast today about about you designing something that had incredible audio specs. But I didn't mean to interrupt your story. So if you would carry on with your early days of discovering electronics.
Well, I decided I had to go to school and learn how all this stuff worked. And so I looked around, and I came from a, shall we say, a relatively poor family. I don't know that we'd be considered poverty level, but certainly didn't have money to go to college. And I looked around, and I discovered a school that actually met my needs very well, Moody Bible Institute. And they had a radio technical course at that time. And so I enrolled there, and they taught me everything that I needed to know for broadcast engineering. And one of the best things I ever learned was from one of the teachers. We had a broadcast, what they called broadcast lab. We were working with real broadcast equipment. And project was just using it and discovering how it worked and how to use it. And unfortunately, since this stuff sat on the shelf most of the year, sometimes when we got to work on it, it didn't work properly. And if you went to the instructor and said, "Mr. Anderson, this doesn't work," his stock answer was, "There's the manual. You're an engineer. Fix it." And that's all he would tell you. And that was a great way to learn how to learn. And when I was in school, out of 4 years of school, we had 2 weeks on transistors. And these were germanium transistors at the time. Silicon was just starting to pop up. There was no such thing as integrated circuits. Computers were unheard of, except for the UNIVAC. But, and of course, that wasn't practical for anything. And everything that I know about computers, about digital audio, I learned since then. And a lot of it was almost all of it was self-taught, or learning from other people that knew more than I did. So after that, I was planning on going to being a radio missionary. Uh-huh. And was actually headed for Aruba.
Oh my!
Now, I know at this time we think, oh, vacation spot
for the rich.
Yeah, at that time there was only one hotel there, and it wasn't much.
Ah.
And they did have a few radio stations there. And I actually got to spend 3 months there. They were putting up a new tower. It was a tower made out of stainless steel.
Hmm.
And it's a somewhat long involved story, but the tower that it was replacing was 8 years old and was rusted out already.
From the salt air, absolutely. Yeah. Gordon, we're going to take a quick break for a sponsor.
Yeah.
When we come back, we're going to shift over to your early career at WFMT. And the very first project you were asked to do was, oh my gosh, all hands on deck. We got to make this happen. So that story is coming up. And then I also want to hear more about a certain manufacturer who made the best FM tuner at the time. and what they recommended you tune into on that tuner. So we're going to check that out too. And then we'll eventually we'll bring you up to date with what Gordon's been doing lately. So, hey, I want to mention our sponsor. One of our sponsors is Angry Audio. And Angry Audio is the proud owner of the Studio Hub line, the whole Studio Hub line. That means all the adapters and connectors. And, you know, Studio Hub really makes wiring your broadcast facility a whole lot easier. And this is a great example of that. This is a Studio Hub. It's called the IHF to Pro audio interface. Now, so many pieces of gear in our lives turns out to be consumer gear. Now, some of it can have pretty good specs, but a lot of it comes out on RCA, unbalanced connectors like these. Well, you know, pro broadcast gear, it's not really built to take unbalanced minus 10 dBV levels coming from consumer gear. We want to bring that up to plus 4 and balanced and at a very low noise floor. Well, that's what this box does. Yeah, I know it's a tiny little box and you can buy interfaces like this that are a whole lot bigger, but this one's small. It's powered right here from the Studio Hub interface. So it gets the plus and minus 15 volts right from the Studio Hub power supply that also carries the plus 4 audio out of this and to your professional broadcast gear. It could be, you know, an analog audio console. It could be a modern piece of gear like an X-Node from Axia, and this RJ45 will just plug right in the back of that X-Node and give you balanced plus 4 dBm audio with excellent noise specs. So this little box, this little puck right here is what does it. There's other boxes from Studio Hub that do some similar things. This particular one, I'll try to get it out of the light here. This one takes unbalanced audio in and gives you AES digital, AES EBU digital out, again with the Studio Hub standard. You can also send the balanced stereo in on an RJ45. So if your piece of gear already has balanced out, you go right in here with the RJ45 Studio Hub standard and you come out AES EBU. And so this one is just an awesome piece of gear. Also, you get you powered here with plus and minus 15 on this input right here. Lots of good things to check out. This is the analog to digital converter, IHF to pro converter, and you can check out lots of good stuff at the Angry Audio website. It's angryaudio.com, and I sure wish you would. You're going to be happy you do because, as they say, problems disappear when you get angry. Hey, the other sponsor that we want to tell you about is Max Connect Wireless. We'll be right back after this quick testimonial.
I'm Gary Morrow, Midwest Regional Director of Engineering for Alpha Media. When I first spoke with Josh Bone about Max Connect, he told me they'd work great for remote transmitter sites where connectivity was a challenge. And you know, he's absolutely right. We even have sites where we're using this as a backup to our STL using Max Connect's dual carrier option, and it works perfectly. We also have times where we need to be able to get out to a venue where it's kind of challenging because everybody and his brother is trying to stream video at the same time, like at a big sporting event. And you know what? Our data gets through every time because it's prioritized packet data. It works for us. It'll work for you. Max Connect. Check it out.
And this is the Max Connect LTE modem, the 4G LTE modem. And there's other ones too, like the one from Cradlepoint, but it's not the modem that makes the difference. It is the SIM card that puts you on the Max Connect wireless network, where you get prioritized 4G LTE data and your data gets through, and a fixed IP address, which is really cool. That's something you don't get from, you know, a hotspot, like if you make it from your phone. So check out Max Connect. com. I know it's spelled all funny. There's a spelling right there on the screen for you if you want to check it out. MaxConnect, maxconnect.com. We'll have the link in the show notes for you as well. Thanks a lot to Josh Bone, who's had this great vision to get prioritized 4G LTE data. Your data goes before everybody else except the police and fire and rescue people. So yeah, your data goes first. All right. Thanks a lot, Max Connect, for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. We're talking to Gordon Carter, who was the longtime, over 40 years, the chief engineer, director of engineering over at WFMT, classical radio station in Chicago, long, long heralded for their audio quality. And I became familiar with WFMT through when I worked in public radio in Kentucky by playing the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. So, Gordon, I know you started at WFMT at some young, tender age. You must have to be there 40 years. Tell us about that.
I had worked at a couple of places, along the East Coast. Prior to that, I was a summer fill-in at a station in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and also worked for a station in Trenton, New Jersey. And it was interesting, when I started there, I was looking for a job, and I didn't have a clue where. I said, well, let's try the station by my hometown. So I found out where their offices were, walked in one day, and asked the secretary if I could speak to the owner. And she said, what for? I said, I'm looking for a job. She said, wait a minute. 20 minutes later, I was hired. So that was a long time ago, a different world. But he didn't want me there. He wanted me at one of his other stations in Trenton. And I went there, was there for a little over a year, and then got this job at a station in Chicago called WFMT. And I started there in January of 1969. And I wasn't that young. I was 24 when I started. And I didn't really know what I was getting into. But
at 24, in the third largest market in the country, was it classical at the time that you went there?
Absolutely.
Okay.
WFMT has always been classical.
Okay.
And I was hired, like I say, January of 69. Within a week or so, the ownership said, by the way, you're going to be operating from new studios the end of April.
What, 3-4 months at the most?
Yeah, 3 months.
And wait a minute. And this was, I got to get a plug. This was before we had Studio Hub.
Angry Audio, yes.
Yes. Oh, my God.
Yes.
You had a lot of solder. Did Christmas you have Christmas trees? Trees? Did you have to solder the Christmas
trees?
Christmas trees. Oh, soldered, gosh, Christmas, no. Oh. Trees. That's terrible.
Yes.
Well, but at least they're low noise.
Well, they can be. It's interesting that you mentioned low noise. Before I was hired at FMT, I was trying to find out something about this station. And I found a magazine article in, I think it was Popular Electronics, that was actually a review of FM tuners at the time. And they were trying to find the best FM tuner. And they came to the conclusion that the best FM tuner was the Marantz 10B. And they put a little note in, but you're kind of out of luck, because if you don't live in Chicago, that's the only place that has WFMT, which is the only station that's worth listening to on this tuner. It will really show what the tuner can do. And that was done, that reputation was earned before any modern technology. This was still all tube type technology at the time. And it was all done because the engineers, I can't take any credit for that, but the engineers at the time were convinced that good engineering was the way to do it. And they did it. So when I started, I was indoctrinated very quickly into the attitude of good engineering, all the way. Do it right, do it the best you can, and do it right the first time. And of course, this was kind of helped by the fact that we had a fairly large contingent of our listeners. I've seen numbers as high as about 10%, which is a pretty high percentage of our listeners were listening in the evenings. After dinner, they would go into their living room, no TV, or the TV was turned off if they had one, turn on their stereo, tune in WFMT and listen to our concert programs while reading a book, magazine, or just listen. But these systems were not, you know, not your run-of-the-mill systems. Many of them were $5,000 to $10,000 systems. Now, in the early 60s, that was a lot of money to put into an audio system. Still is, but then it was even more. And so these people expected the best, and we were there to give them the best. And that was part of the way we were expected to work. So that's what we did.
I got to believe that, back in those days, we didn't have audio processors that just really crunched things up. I mean, you could make your station sound bad even back then, but we didn't have as many opportunities to make them sound bad, at least not on purpose. And there was so much tube equipment. Now, I started in public radio back in the mid 1970s, and I remember that we had to be careful about levels, and I know they did some care and feeding of the few. I think most everything was solid state, but there may have been a couple of tube items. Well, certainly the transmitter. But I guess my point is this: classical music is not very good at hiding audio problems, whereas compressed contemporary music, you can hide your own problems to some degree with that. If there's some distortion, well, that may have been how the band wanted it to sound. I mean, they do make guitar boxes called fuzz boxes, but you don't find any fuzz boxes on the stage of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. So tell me kind of, what was your overriding strategy to sound good in the late 60s, early 1970s? What was your goal was to sound clean and good, and what was your strategy to get there?
Everything in the audio chain had to be the best it could be, and it had to work right. I mean, you couldn't tolerate something that was, shall we say, a little out of sorts, shall we say. So, for instance, a turntable. Most people would take a turntable, they put the cartridge in the tone arm, plop it down, and play. We would spend an hour when we put that in, making sure it was properly aligned. We had, how many radio stations had CBS test records? How many of them had alignment protractors or turntables and stylus pressure gauges? We did. And we use them every day. And it's amazing. You take a phonostylus, if it's not perfectly vertical, left to right, what you're playing doesn't sound right. All of these things didn't cost a penny to do it. It just took a little time and a little care to do it right. And everything else the same way. We did what we could with the electronics that we had. As time went on, we actually ended up building our own electronics. There were, at the time, I mean, think about it, in the late 60s, early 70s, there were really no really quality audio boards out there, except in recording studios. Our friends at PR&E hadn't come along yet. And so there was we were limited in what we had. In fact, a lot of the studio gear that we used, you mentioned this in the ad for Angry Audio, was hi-fi gear because it was better. We had, for instance, Sony turntables, Marantz phono preamps. And so on and so forth. We were one of the first radio stations to use Dolby A on tape recorders. In fact, our program director swore up, down, and backwards that it was not good because it had to be destroying the high end of the tape or the high end of the spectrum because there was no noise.
Did you get to explain to him how it worked and that it scientifically was based on some sound ideas?
He was the type of person you couldn't quite do that.
Okay.
But we were able to convince him that yes, it was all there. It was doing it the right way.
Okay. All right. I'm curious, in the 1980s, along came a company that was very well regarded by many people for phono preamps, and that was Bill Sachs and Straight Wire Audio. Did you ever get to play with any of his gear, and did you find any benefit there?
I'm trying to remember. We did not. We were aware of his stuff, but we didn't have any. We were using the Marantz preamps for quite a while, and then in the early 80s, we started using some preamps from Apt Holman.
Okay, all right.
I don't know if you're familiar with them. They were Tom Holman, who was somewhere up in Massachusetts, I believe. But he had a small company that was doing stereo equipment. And he was making a very good phono preamp at the time. And we used that. And
okay.
He later went on to work for a small startup company called THX.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay, sure. Sure. THX. Absolutely. Well, it sounds like phono preamps may have been even more esoteric than the Straight Wire Audio. Straight Wire Audio was, for guys who didn't really jump into the design of electronics, they just heard the grapevine that Bill Sachs was making some really good phono preamps. Not sure why. Let's buy them and put them in. And sure enough, they may have been a little bit better than the Rusco ones that we were using.
Oh, yeah, they were. By 1995, we were almost at the other end of the extreme where there were almost no phono preamps available, at which time I ended up designing my own, which they actually, I think, were the best phono preamps I've ever heard.
Hey, we're going to take a quick break. We're talking to Gordon Carter. And Gordon, I want to mention to you one thing. And when we come back from the break, maybe you can tell a story if you've ever made a mistake like I made. I was a fairly fresh engineer at a rock station in Lexington, Kentucky. And one evening, I kind of rewired the phono preamps under the turntables. The wiring was just kind of ratty. And I felt like it needed to get redone. And I redid it, but I made a mistake. on one of the turntables, I accidentally plugged left into right and right into left. And therefore, if you knew what to listen for and were listening in stereo, you might hear your favorite song with the guitar solo panned the wrong way. And to me, it made no I got a call the next day from a listener. He said, "Hey, man, your left and right are like mixed up, man. And like the drums are not where they're supposed to be." And so I said, because I didn't know this was a thing. I didn't think it actually mattered because it wasn't a classical station. You know, and I said, "Well, dude, turn your chair around." He said, "That's not nice, man. You need to fix that." So I did. I went and fixed it and realized my horrible mistake of transposing left and right. When we come back from the break, Gordon, maybe you'll have a little embarrassing story that you could tell us like that. We're going to be back with Gordon Carter in just a minute. It's This Week in Radio Tech, episode 570. Gordon Carter, the 41-year engineer for WFMT in Chicago, is on with us. And we're going to hear from our friends at Innovonics. And we'll be right back.
The Aran 655 is the latest addition to the Innovonics family of rebroadcast receivers, designed specifically for FM broadcast translators, also referred to as relay transmitters. The Aran 655 is unique as an uncompromising DSP-based HD radio and FM receiver combined with a powerful 3-band audio processor and dynamic RDS encoder. IP connectivity adds streaming capabilities, and a web browser interface gives you total remote control of the unit from any PC or mobile device. The Aran 655 gives you maximum flexibility for program sources. Select program audio from analog FM, digital channels HD 1 through 8, streaming sources, and analog or AES digital line inputs, all with assignable failover audio backup. The internal RDS encoder allows you to customize your RDS messaging. You can use incoming off-air RDS data, convert HD radio pad data to RDS, convert streamed metadata to RDS, or receive IP telnet data. Comprehensive audio processing includes gated and windowed AGC, a unique syllabic leveler, 3 bands of compression, and both wideband and independent HF limiting. Easy setup is achieved by using 10 factory presets and 10 customizable presets. The processor also supports dayparting, allowing automatic preset changes to follow different programming formats throughout your broadcast day. The front panel has an OLED display and jog wheel with intuitive menus for easy setup, advanced control, and editing for all operating parameters. The Aran 655 dynamic web interface gives you total remote control of the unit from any PC or mobile device. A comprehensive set of menus includes a quick overview of now playing info, input-output control, processor options, RDS encoder, alarms and notifications, SNMP settings, and much more. You can also listen to the live audio broadcast streamed through the web interface.
Check out the Aran 655 from Innovonics, and you can get it from Broadcasters General Store. Their website, bgs.cc. bgs.cc. And you can call them. They're really set up for you to call and talk to them. Get the advice you're looking for, find out the availability of different products, and of course, your discounted price. Call them at 352-622-7700. 352-622-7700, Broadcasters General Store. Thanks a lot, BGS, for your sponsorship, and thank you, if you're watching or listening, for patronizing our sponsors. It really helps out. Gordon Carter is my guest, the 41-year engineer at WFMT. Gordon, we were talking briefly about the CBS professional test record, and during the break, or just before the break, our friend and listener Tim Braddock took a picture of his copy of the CBS. I'm sorry, that's the best I can do there, but he's got the technical series professional test record from CBS Labs. How about that?
Actually, they had several different versions of that.
Ah. Well, that's the one that I think
we had all of them.
Yeah.
One was a brown label, there was a blue label, there was a red label, and they were all different.
Oh, okay. We also have a big howdy from someone you know from Chicago. Edward Glab says hi, and he's asking, when is SBE in Chicago getting back together in person? He wants to know that.
That's a good question.
Yeah.
It's a question that a lot of chapters are asking.
Yeah. We need to talk to a few politicians on that for one thing.
Oh, you might have to meet out. Go meet in Peoria or maybe over in Indiana. I don't know.
It'd have to be Indiana.
Yeah. Hey, so I told an embarrassing story. Is there anything you'd like to tell us that might,
along those same lines, I don't know that I ever did anything quite that embarrassing, but I do know that at FMT, if the channels got reversed, the phones were ringing instantly. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but if the turntables were running a little off speed, we'd get phone calls.
Oh, from those perfect pitch listeners.
Absolutely. And the thing is, they were right.
Uh-huh.
You go in and put a strobe disc on. Sure enough, they're off.
My goodness. Wow.
We were so glad when the SP10 and SP15 turntables came out.
Oh.
Because they had a built-in strobe, and the SP15, of course, had the plus or minus 9.9% VeriSpeed.
Right.
Which was digitally set, so you could get that right on the money. Hmm. So that kind of ended those phone calls.
So one of the things that I want to make sure we have time for this because I promoted it so heavily, this big thing you designed that had the incredibly low noise floor, you made a product that wasn't available yet, or at least not the quality that you needed yet. Tell us about this big project that turned out to be exquisite.
A quick background on this. I mentioned that we moved in 1969. Well, by the late 1970s, we were badly outgrowing that space. That room, that facility had two control rooms and two studios. And that was it. No place to put anything more. And by that time, we had grown. We were doing many different syndications, Chicago Symphony, Lyric Opera, Milwaukee Symphony. I couldn't even begin to guess how many there were at that time. But a lot of big syndications that required production space. Plus, we were looking at other things, so we needed more space. And so we decided to move, and in 1981, we moved to new facilities, which were much larger. And we decided that one of the things that this facility needed was it had to be the best. And we had, by this time, had several years' experience with a lot of different things. We knew an awful lot of things that didn't work or didn't work to our satisfaction. One of the things we knew that a facility like this needed was flexibility. We had to move a lot of audio around and to a lot of different places. And we knew that, first of all, patch bays were just not the answer. They were, first of all, you had to walk up to it and do something to change it. And second, we had found that in many cases, especially with classical music, because the audio levels sometimes were so low, that patch bays would become very unreliable. So we decided that we would build this facility without patch bays, and needed an audio routing switcher. So we started looking to buy one. Problem was, in 1980 and 81, there were no stereo, high-quality routing switchers out there. The only routing switchers were video or audio follow video for TV, and they were all mono. If you wanted to do stereo, you could hook two of them together, but really there was nothing stereo. And the other thing was that we had some criteria that we wanted to meet. One of them, we were using a lot of tape at the time. At that facility, we had over 30 tape recorders. And no matter how good the tape recorder is or how good the operator is, sooner or later, someone's going to fast forward or rewind a tape over the heads with the pot open. And now you have these super high frequencies audio sounds going through the system, and if you're not careful, they would get into everything. And we knew that what we had to do was build a system or come up with a system that would handle that. And there was nothing available that we could find. So I set out to build one. And we started off by trying to figure, okay, how big does it need to be? Always a good question to ask. And we figured, well, we really need, I think we figured something on the order of 40 or 50 outputs with just about as many inputs on the whole system, which is a pretty big system, no matter how you slice it. And in those days, that was a very big system. And we said, okay, we know how big it needs to be. Now, how do we do it? We discovered a chip from Siliconics that would, it wasn't designed as an audio switcher, but it worked real well. It was actually a CMOS analog switch, but it would use 5 volt to 15 volt logic, but it would pass audio at plus or minus 15 volts. And we got some, we played with them, experimented, found out how to use them, and get good results out of it, and set out to design circuit boards. So we built the system, and I will admit we were a little surprised as to how good it was, because not only did it meet our expectations, it exceeded them. We ended up with a system that we could have expanded it to 256 by 256 stereo cross points, but we measured 103 dB below plus 4 as the noise. We were able to measure audio level or audio tones at 0.0022% THD at plus 4 through the system. And we were not able to detect any crosstalk at any frequency. And there was nothing like it at the time. We really were very happy. And by the way, we added a few things because we could. Again, remember that this was before PCs, before
right.
all that good stuff. And but we were doing a display, an alphanumeric display, 8-character alphanumeric display that would show what each destination, what the source was assigned to it in English.
Okay. Yeah.
And we, actually were working after the fact, after we built this and had it installed, a sort of, shall we say, personal interest. We were looking at the possibility of expanding this because along the way we had discovered how to do a few other things with the audio. One was how to build a volume control that was digitally controlled, up, not down, and you could put a preset in there if you wanted.
Okay.
And we actually used that concept in a monitor system that we built using the same technology throughout the system. And so we had that. We knew how to do summation. And so we were thinking, well, you know, this would be a lot. We could make a much better console if we could just put it all in one package, put it in the rack room, let it sit there, remote control it.
It kind of sounds like what we're doing today in audio, in the audio over IP world.
Yeah. And I don't know. I have not been able to get the same quality test equipment on the audio over IP gear, but I really wonder if it would meet or exceed if, which was better.
Yeah. Yeah.
From I hear audio you. Standpoint.
Yeah. Wow. Well, yeah, well, in the AOIP world, typically for the analog inputs and outputs, we're about 102 dB noise floor. And on
well,
the
that's AESC, about where we were.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's dependent upon the, you know, the input and output chips. The AOIP itself is typically 24 bit. The math is typically done at least at 20 bit, maybe 21 or 22 bits. And then if you're AES EBU in and out, then you're 100, what is it, like 130 dB noise down, because you're at, you know, 20, well, I think it's 24 bits anyway. But that was amazing for that time. You told me about how you controlled it. That was pretty interesting. I was going to ask, did you have some kind of display, or was it very cryptic to make a routing change? Could the ordinary operators do that, or did they have to call you and make a route?
No, it was a piece of cake. It was a two-step arrangement, depending on where it was located in the system. We had pardon me for the lapse here. I'm just trying to remember. In most cases, the basic design was you push a button to select the destination. And that would light a light to show you that it's active. And that was, there was a timer on that. So if you forgot, it would time out and go back to safe mode. And then you would select your source. So it was destination, source. When you selected the source, it immediately went to it. So it was as fast. How fast can you push two buttons?
Huh. Wow. Hey, Gordon, we're going to run out of time in the next 10 minutes or so. There's a couple things that I'd like to cover. You told me yesterday, and I just want to bring this up because this was my first exposure to WFMT, was playing back Chicago Symphony Orchestra, CSO, concerts on analog reel-to-reel tape, remembering that you guys, more than anybody else, you guys would fill the reel up and then some with the thinnest tape known to man, because I want to say you got close to 2 hours of audio onto a 10-inch reel, and nobody else was doing that. Am I right in my recollection about that? Because I had to be gingerly careful with your tape, and if I wasn't careful...
Yeah, I think we were doing about an hour 45.
Okay. Hour 45 on something that most people put an hour worth of tape on. And I remember we at the public station that I worked at when I was 15 years old, had these RCA branded reel to reel machines that they could pull a car out of a ditch if you needed them to. I mean, they were unbelievably strong. So you had to be careful about not stretching that tape that came from the Chicago Symphony Orchestra and WFMT. How did you, and you had 400 affiliates? You had to make that many tapes? How did you get that done? I mean, in real time, that's a lot of duplicating. And then you had to check them for quality. Can you give us a really brief overview of how you accomplished that?
You want that now or after the break?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, do it now, and then we'll take a break.
Well, this actually predates that move and was my first exposure to those analog switch chips, different configuration, but we used it. Someone had come up with the idea that, and I can't take credit for the idea, but they said, if we could build a scanning monitor to scan the playback of all of these tapes as they're being recorded, we could do quality control as they're being recorded.
Now, just to put some context, you're playing back one master, recording it on a whole bunch of machines. How many machines would be recording for this duplicating process, this real-time duplicating?
We had, as I remember, 28 machines, but we could have handled 32.
Okay, so you're 1 to 32, did you say 400 affiliates you had to make? And of course, I worked at WEKU-FM. That was one of them. So you're making 28 tapes at a time. But what if somebody threaded a machine wrong and got the tape backwards? That was not going to duplicate well. So that's what the monitoring was for.
Right. The beauty of it is that it would, because you're listening to, say, 5, 10, and by the way, the dwell time was adjustable, how long it sat on each machine. But usually we were doing 5 to 10 seconds per, just cycling through. If there's a bad one, it just jumps right out at you.
So you had an operator who would just sit there and listen, and your scanner that you designed.
Yeah, and you don't have to do critical listening.
Right. It would go from machine to machine to listen to the playback head while the duplication was taking place.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. All right. And we would, by the way, at WEKU, we would check them again when we got them in. And hopefully the person checking the tape wouldn't stretch the tape. And then we'd play it back whenever I was on the air, a weekend show or something. All right.
Tape recorder salesman loved us.
I'm sure. And then let's see, how what part of a week? I mean, you had to have full-time people doing this duplicating.
Yeah, we had a staff of 3 or 4 people.
Wow.
That were doing that.
And, you know, then we went to satellite, I'm sure, for distribution. And then we could have gone, maybe they do FTP download now, or maybe satellite still.
Yeah, we went to satellite. When we went to satellite, we had another challenge, and that was trying to start all of our tapes on a schedule.
Mm.
And if you know anything about people, you realize that if you have a person whose only job it is to push a start button at a specific time, sooner or later, it's not going to happen.
You know, people are the best and people are the worst.
Both ways. So we built an automation system to do that.
Uh-huh. Wow.
That's a whole other story.
We got to take our last break. And when we come back, Gordon, we're just going to have a few minutes for you to tell us a story of what's happening now, where you've been able to put this knowledge to work. I think we kind of skipped the meaning of the podcast originally, planning ensures success. We've been talking about all the getting ready to do the planning, but we're going to be out of time here in just a few minutes. This Week in Radio Tech, I'm Kirk Harnack. We're with Gordon Carter, the 41-year engineer at WFMT in Chicago. If you were ever involved in public radio, I know you heard of WFMT, and you ended up hearing the results of equipment and facilities that Gordon was responsible for designing and building and maintaining. We're going to be right back. Our show is brought to you in part by our friends at Broadcast Bionics, also very concerned with quality over in the UK, and the Camera One system. We'll be right back.
Camera One from Broadcast Bionics, designed to bring video to your audio content, visualizing radio and podcasts for social media. Camera One can automatically create, capture, and brand professionally switched video for live streaming or upload, making your production shareable. Control and configure using a web browser on any device. Camera One is available as a 4-camera or 8-camera system using the Blackmagic A10 Mini range, including the A10 Mini Extreme. You can use cameras to suit your studio and your budget. You'll need one camera for a studio wide shot and usually one camera per microphone. A standard multi-channel sound card or IP driver monitors audio from each studio microphone, and we work natively with Axia systems. Ideally, this will be a post-fader feed from each mic, although you can use pre-fade audio or a mic split if that's all you have available. These audio levels are used to intelligently switch the video feed when each contributor is talking. You can also group microphones together into one shot and use the audio from a mixer's aux bus. You can use Camera One's auto switch feature, or disable it and switch using the on-screen buttons or the buttons on the ATEM. Recordings can automatically start when you tell the system you're on the air. This on-air indication can be linked to your studio's red lights via IP or an Avantech Atom GPIO interface. You can quickly browse all the videos that have been automatically created during your broadcast, download them, and post. Camera One is a user-installable system. You'll need a good spec Windows 10 PC, i7 with plenty of storage, and 16GB of RAM. It's better if this machine isn't used for anything else. Remember, you can control the software in a web browser on another device on your network. Camera One, a thrifty way of creating scroll-stopping video from your show or podcast from Broadcast Bionics.
You can check out Camera One and lots of other products from Broadcast Bionics by going to their website at bionic.radio. Bionic.radio, or call your favorite dealer in the U.S., for example, if you're in the U.S., and ask about Broadcast Bionics Camera One. Really cool system, and as he said, it's thrifty. Thanks a lot to Broadcast Bionics for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech, and please do patronize them. All right, we just got a few remaining minutes, and I mean like 5 minutes tops with Gordon Carter. Gordon, where has all this learning, where has this led you? What planning do you do based upon the learning that you did? What can you leave us with as walkaway advice?
Well, I think I'm no different from most radio engineers. What is the one thing that most radio engineers hate most about the job? The 3 a.m. phone calls?
Well, there's that. Yes. Okay. Yeah, being on call 24/7 and actually having to do it. Yeah.
Right. And, in that respect, I'm no different from anyone else. But I did learn that if you put your system together, plan your system right, and then put it together right, a lot of those calls don't happen because everything works. Yeah, sometimes things break. And that's going to happen we're human, and anything we build will fail sooner or later. But if you get rid of all of the stupid things that cause things to fail, like, okay, you forgot to change the filter on your transmitter. You just do it. And plan. Think through what can happen and then fix it before it does. And I think that sums it up in a hurry. And I try to do that with everything that I work on. And for the most part, it works. I went for quite a long time where no phone calls in the middle of the night. It was a combination of a nighttime operator who really was moderately, what's the word I'm looking for? Moderately proficient. Mm. It wasn't that he would miss things. I mean, the particular the person I have in mind actually was ADD, and he didn't miss anything.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
But he also was smart enough to know, shall we say, the how to bypass a lot of the problems. He knew this. You know, he knew how to take secondary action, mm-hmm. and didn't mm-hmm. have to call me. And
that's great.
Okay, uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's good.
I guess I had a similar philosophy. If I had to fix something once, okay, I really need to keep an eye on it. But if I had to fix it twice, we're going to make a change. We're going to do something different. We're going to really figure out why it's breaking, what's going wrong. If it's a human error, if it's a bad design, if I didn't fix it right the first time, you know, was it me? That kind of thing. The other thing I did, Gordon, was now you were a full-time employee. I was typically a contract engineer, but I had it arranged so that they couldn't call me first. Only the program director could call me. So if they had if an overnight operator had a problem, he had to call the PD first and wake him up, and they had to work on it together. And if okay, we can't figure this out, let's call Kirk.
I found another thing that's a big help.
Yeah.
Write instructions.
Yeah.
How many stations have you walked into and, okay, everyone knows how to do what they do every day. Mm-hmm. But what do you do if this doesn't work? They don't have a clue. And there's nothing written to tell them how. And quite frankly, that particular job is made a lot easier by modern technology. We now have computers. First of all, it's easy to sit down and type, no matter how bad a typist you are. But you can type, you can insert pictures, yeah. and you can then diagram. You can easily draw flowcharts, and sometimes you have to use a combination of things to show people how to do it. Just this week, earlier in the week, I've been working, I work part-time for WMBI, and been working on resurrecting some analog tape recorders. Mm-hmm. They're using it to get some old tapes digitized. Mm-hmm. And one of the big questions, no one knows how to clean tape heads anymore.
Of course they wouldn't, right? They wouldn't know how.
So what did I do? I snapped a couple of pictures with my cell phone, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. of the tape path, transferred them into my computer, drew a couple of lines, do this here.
And make sure they have cotton swabs and some 91% isopropyl alcohol or denatured.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they have the supplies. They just, and it was interesting that when they had a machine. Now they have, well, they'll soon have five, but mm-hmm. they were cleaning, but they were missing areas. They cleaned the surface of the head, but they missed the guides.
Oh,
the guides were awful.
Oh, yeah.
And the other thing you don't do is you don't use that alcohol on the pinch roller.
Right. Oh, good point. Good point. And don't use WD-40 on the pinch roller either. That doesn't help. Be careful with that. Gordon, we're out of time. I know that our producer, Suncast, has got to go. And we've been going at this for a little over an hour. I think we could easily spend another hour together, but I appreciate your time so dearly. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Gordon Carter, WFMT for 41 years, and now doing occasional consulting with various people, including Moody Bible Institute and their radio network. So, Gordon, thanks for taking the time this week to be with us and sharing your knowledge. It's greatly appreciated.
You're welcome.
And I want to thank Suncast for producing This Week in Radio Tech. Suncast, our producer, appreciate you. And also thanks to Andrew Zarian, the founder of the GFQ Network. Andrew is doing some other pretty cool projects, too. You may hear Andrew on your local radio station doing a wrestling show. So that's going to be pretty cool. Hey, we got to go. I'm Kirk Harnack. Gordon Carter has been my guest. And please tell all your friends about This Week in Radio Tech. You'll find us on Facebook. You'll find us on YouTube. And you'll find us at the GFQ Network at gfqnetwork.com. All right, we'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.